Well, this is exciting. A whole new place. Are you all? I'm not going to be galloping around the place, so I think it's probably important that you can see me and see a screen. So maybe adjust yourself as appropriate. This is lecture 8, and is basically going to be the last of the maths bits. We're going to finish off part 3 today, and move on to physics next time. Hooray! Now, there's quite a lot to get through, and this is quite an intricate one. I don't think it's terribly deep, but it is quite intricate. So I propose to get on with things without too much ado. I can't think of any announcements, but are there any questions to do with stuff? Nope. As far as I'm aware, we're in here from now on. So we've left the other room behind. Can you hear me okay at the back end there? No, I'm seeing a thumbs up and a sort of middle. I shall aim to project suitably. I think this is actually a designed lecture theatre, so I think this will probably have substantially better acoustics than the room we've been in so far. Pity the poor astronomy too, because they've been going from room to room to room, sometimes with a day's notice. So you have, you know, whatever the acoustics of 446 or 466, it could have been worse. Okay, where we got to last time was talking about quite a lot of slides in this one. We defined differentiation and discovered that with this definition of covariant differentiation, the metric tensor had the property that its covariant derivative was zero. And I mention that partly because it's interesting, partly because it justifies our ascription of the idea of the metric providing a length, which we just took for granted. It's that property that makes that a reasonable thing to take the metric to be a definition of length. And also because working that out was a useful way of using some of the mathematical technology we had built up to that point. So there were a couple of different payoffs, distinct payoffs for that. Now, the next thing we're going to talk about is a crucial idea, the notion of geodesics. Now, geodesic, as we'll discover, is the next best, it's not the next best thing, it is what a straight line is in a flat space, and the thing that most naturally corresponds to a straight line in a curved space. And so we have to talk about what a geodesic is. And to do that, we have to go back to the idea of what parallel transport was. And that's what happens if you parallel transport a vector along a curve. So imagine let's take, first of all, a vector field, which is, at each point in the space, there is a vector, these solid arrows defined. There's a V, let's say, at each point in the space. Now let's have a curve, that curve there. And that curve will have a function like lambda of t or whatever it is. So as we change lambda t, we move through the space along a path in a particular way, parameterized by the particular functional form of lambda that we choose. Remember the distinction between a path and a set of points and a curve as one of the multiple possible ways you could parameterize that set of points as a function of a parameter t. And as we learned at the beginning of this part, if you have that structure, then you can define a vector as the directional derivative, or the derivative as you vary the curve parameter, let's say t, so that you can define the notion of tangent vectors. And this is a curve where we have tangent vectors which vary as the curve moves about. Now, it's clear that as you go along this curve, the vector field changes, very obviously. So these more specifically, if you parallel transport this initial vector along this curve, then it's, then you deviate from the direction that you start off. The curve, if you like, turns a corner. That curve bends. It bends in the sense that do I have a diagram of this? It bends in the sense that if you had a curve a vector like that, and you parallel transport it along a curve like that, could I lock the focus of that? Autofocus. Autofocus, awkward. So this curve bends in the sense it deviates from the set of parallel transported initial vectors here in the way that this curve doesn't. So we already have a sort of intrinsic notion of what a straight line is, just from that picture. If what we're doing is we are parallel transporting this tangent vector along the curve, and it stays tangent to the curve in that nice straight line. Parallel transporting this tangent vector along the curve, it does not remain tangent to the curve. That curve bends in a entirely coordinate-free way. It depends on our definition of the covariant derivative and thus of the parallel transport, but given that, it's a bendy curve. And a curve which doesn't do that, like this, is a curve which, when you parallel transport that curve along the curve, so that's the derivative of this tensor is the derivative of the field of U along the direction of the curve. If that stays parallel, then that directional derivative will remain zero. That may take a couple of goes to seep in, but what I've written down there is the sort of mathematical version of this idea of the vector not the vector being parallel transport, the tangent vector being parallel transported in such a way that it remains a tangent vector. Right, now, that's very pretty. It's four symbols, and it means, I'm telling you, it means a huge amount. But it's not something you can very straightforwardly calculate with. So how do you calculate with that? How do you find a curve which satisfies that equation? And here we get slightly intricate. That microphone is annoying me. But I see no way of turning it down. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to have to refer to this just so I don't make any index mistakes. Remember that U is equal to something like U, J, E, J in the usual fashion. So the I'm going to remind ourselves that this tensor, remember that this Nabla U is a tensor, a 1-1 tensor. In other words, it's something which takes a vector-shaped argument and a one-form-shaped argument, but we write it in an odd way so that the the vector argument we write down here for notation, like for reasons of notational convenience. So there's nothing deep there; it's just handy. So that which means that this expression here, Nabla U
is really just Nabla U with the
one of the with the vector argument pre-filled in. But since that's the argument to a tensor, it's linear in that argument. So Nabla U will be equal to Nabla U K E K U, which that being linear in that argument, that pops out to be now U K Nabla, and remember E K U, and remember the notational shortcut that rather than writing this double subscript here, we end up writing that as U. So that's U. That's U. U K Nabla K U equals zero. So this is just a sequence of there's just a bit of notational jiggery-pokery happening here. There's nothing terribly deep.
Okay.
But we have an expression for this. This expression here, we saw what that was in the last lecture but one. So that expression there, I'll copy this down just so I make sure I get the equation right, is going to be
U J Nabla J U will be equal to U J U I semicolon J E I.
Okay. Just recalling the component version of the covariant derivative that we saw last time.
And that means, which is equal to, recalling the expansion of that, U J U I comma J plus U J U K gamma I J K equals zero.
So again, we're just using the expression for this the set of components that we learned last time, or time before last. Now, we haven't said anything very much about the curve that this curve we're talking about here. This curve here, but it'll be this curve here will be lambda of t. For some suitable, I use the word suitable carefully, some suitable curve lambda. And what we learned before is that this tangent vector is the operator d by dt. That we learned that at the beginning of this part. That was our definition of vectors in this context. So if we then, which means that this uj, the jth component of that vector, is going to be u applied to dxj, that gradient of one of the that's the basis one forms corresponding to the basis vectors. With the component basis vectors, which equals dxj by dt. Just the derivative of that component along the... this is fairly directly saying, given a curve, that line there, the component of this vector is just how much that the x or the y or the whatever component varies as you move along that curve, and that means that looking at this other term, u I comma j is just d by dx j dx i
by dt. And that means that this expression here is dxj by dt dx by dx j dxi by dt plus gamma I j k dxj by dt, there's complete derivatives dxk by dt equals zero. And that combination there is ends up giving me d by dt dx I by dt plus gamma I j k dx j by dt dx k by dt equals zero. So we have turned this elegant but rather impenetrable equation, which we jumped at from considering what a straight line consists of, we've turned that into a second order differential equation in the functions in the coordinate functions x of t, and that's a second order of differential equation. So from the theory of second order differential equations, you can discover that that will have a solution, and that solution is an expression for the path followed by that geodesic, or by a path which satisfies this property in the coordinates x of t, xi of t. I don't see any worried faces particularly, but okay. And a couple of bits of remark. I'd said that this curve lambda was a suitable curve, and it's not an arbitrary curve that will do that. There is a subset of curves which will form suitable solutions to that. But once you have a solution, lambda of t, if lambda of t lambda of t is a geodesic, then that means that lambda of a t plus b is very hard to write at that precise angle, and that is a parameter t which has that property is known as an affine parameter. And what that affine parameter is doing, saying that it's affine, saying that this set of rescalings of that parameter, what that's telling you is that you can rescale and shift the curves, the parameters of your geodesics more or less at will, which makes sense because if you measure time in seconds. And you have a geodesic that goes through that describes the fall of a ball. You can also, whatever that equation of motion is, you can also rescale it and talk about it not in seconds since midnight, but in hours since 2 o'clock, for example. So you can change you can rescale the parameter, in this case time, and you can shift the origin arbitrarily, and that is. And one way of saying that, or a very well-known way of talking about that, is that affine parameters are defined so that motion looks simple. If you were to decide that, rather than talking about seconds, I'm going to write down my geodesic equation in terms of seconds squared, you'd be silly, because that would make your geodesic a really complicated your expression for a parabola. It would make a parabola rewritten in terms of seconds squared from midnight. Is going to be a mess.
motion looks simple in the when you're using the when you pick a form for the your geodesic, which is an affine parameter. I'm slightly to go around circles here, but there's a more apophthegmatic way of saying that. But the point of saying it is just to mention this word affine, and to try and link the that there's a mathematical property that there's a family of solutions to a geodesic equation to something more slightly more physical. That is what it all I have to say for the moment about geodesics. Is there anything more I can add? Or okay, then let's move on, because now we come to the as it were the main event, talking about curvature. And I think it's important to have a clear idea of an affine parameter is the time coordinate of some inertial system. And remember, I said by inertial system, I meant a system in which, for example, you're jumping up and down. A system in which Newton's laws work. A system in free fall is an inertial system. And an affine parameter, the parameter of a geodesic, is a time parameter in that. And we'll come back to that notion of that particular statement of this implicitly later on. Given the key points, we can define a geodesic equation. The process of asking where does if I throw something in a given space, where does it go? That is you solving the geodesic equation to find an equation of motion. So the answer to the geodesic equation, the solution to the geodesic equation, is essentially an equation of motion. It's the equation of a line in your space. That's the sort of vector version of the equation. That's simply the component version of the same equation, with a tangent vector, which is parallel transported along a curve to remain being a tangent vector. Anyway, moving on, talking about curvature, I've drawn there a surface of a sphere, for example, the Earth. And if you imagine starting at the equator and pointing north, you point north. I think that's north. And you keep walking in a straight line, in other words, along a geodesic. So a geodesic is, I think I said this earlier, a geodesic is a straight line. In Euclidean space, a geodesic is a straight line in the conventional fashion. It's with the signature of Euclidean space, a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. In Minkowski space, or something with the signature of special relativity, a straight line is the longest distance between two points. All of the alternative versions of going from A to B in Minkowski space are shorter than the straight line. On the surface of a sphere, a straight line is a great circle. That has the same signature as Euclidean space, and so it's the shortest distance. So I start at the equator, I point north, and I walk north. I just keep walking in a straight line, and eventually I will get to the North Pole. And at that point, if I started at zero latitude, at that point I'm pointing toward the 180 degree latitude. I then start walking sideways and head back down to the equator, still pointing in the original direction. So I don't turn round. I end up back at the equator, this time pointing along the equator. I then walk back around 90 degrees and end up back where I started, but this time still pointing along the equator. So I haven't changed the direction I'm pointing at any point, and I've been walking in straight lines in each case. But of course, when I get back to where I started, I'm pointing in a different direction. If the angle I went through at the North Pole was smaller, then this deflection would be smaller, but it would still be a deflection. In other words, going for a walk and staying pointing in the same direction allows me to pick up some information about the the curved surface. It's the fact that the Earth is curved that I can tell the story. I go up to the North Pole, got to come down and back. And clearly, I don't have to go all the way to the North Pole. I could clearly do this in any, with any circular route. But so the deflection of this this vector through a circuit is telling us something about the curvature of that. Obviously, it's telling us something about the curvature of that surface in a way which is completely independent of components. So we haven't talked about components or coordinates or anything like that at this point. So there's a geometrical this is a geometrical thing we're picking up by this process. So what we need to do now is find a way of capturing that intuition in a mathematical form to get some expression, some thing we can calculate with that will talk about the curvature. So that's what we're talking about of a space. So the way we do that is a rather intricate but not fundamentally deep process. So this, let me pull it right here. So I'm going to set up a path to go around. Let's have two coordinates here. We'll call this first one x sigma, and that's for example, x versus y, or r versus theta, whatever you like. And that line there is the line where x sigma is equal to a. And we'll draw another line through the space, x sigma equals a plus delta A. So that's just moving along a bit. And we'll have another pair of lines, of constant coordinate lines, where x lambda equals b, x lambda equals b plus delta b. And as you can guess, this delta A and delta B I'm going to make small later. And so this is the tangent vector corresponding to the sigma coordinate. So that's the direction in which the sigma coordinate changes. And this is the direction in which the x lambda coordinate changes. And we'll start off with a vector v at this point A. And we'll do what I described for, in this case, we'll take this vector for a walk around this path. We'll take it to B, we'll take it to C, we'll take it to D, and we'll bring it back to A and discover that, a slightly unfortunate location of these, that there's a change in the vector, which is picked up as it goes around that circuit, and we want to it's picked that up by virtue of going around that curved space. And what we want to do is work out the size of that vector there, and how it picks up information about the space as we go around it. Now, by transporting the vector, I mean parallel transporting it. Remember I said, in this case, I'm parallel transporting that vector up to there, parallel transport down to here, and parallel transporting it back. So I'm parallel transporting it in each case. Okay. In other words, in such a way that the covariant derivative is zero. So we know how to do that. So by parallel transporting the vector v, along this first leg, that is as saying that it'll be parallel transport in such a way that the vector v as parallel transported along e sigma, this vector here, will be zero. What that means is that again, v I comma sigma will be equal to minus gamma I k sigma v k, and that's just the expression for the covariant derivative and component form
rearranged for the case where it's zero. Right. Now, what's the result of that going to be? What is the vector? Well, let's call that the vector at A. What's the vector, the value of the vector V going to be at B? That is going to be the vector. Well, let's stick with. Sorry, we're going to go with individual components. The component, the ith component at A, plus the changes in that component as we move along. So it'd be the integral from A to B of dv, I by dx sigma dx sigma. So I'm just integrating the derivative along the curve to get the result. Vi A minus I K sigma V K dx sigma. And this A to B is moving from x sigma equals A to x sigma equals A plus delta A, Vi at A minus integral of A to A plus delta A dx sigma, evaluated at along this line x lambda equals B. And that's the neat version of what I'm drawing here. That's what I've just written down. And it's clear that we can by this means get the value of the ith component of V at B from A. We can get to the value of the ith component of C from B in the same way, and so on, and end up with I ask you to think what that may be. That is one of the exercises. I encourage you to think through. It's one of the quick exercises at the end, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but this is just an exercise in keeping track of signs, really. But the end result, when you get all the signs right and go through step by step, is this pattern of pluses and minuses, and this set of specific integrals. So this is integrating from A to B, this is integrating from point B to point C, point C to point D, and point D back to point A. Messy, fiddly, but not nothing more exotic is happening than here. Now we can take advantage. We haven't at this point taken advantage of the fact that delta A and delta B are small, so we can do that. The way we do that is by saying that the expression such as this for picking, which one I'm picking here. Yes, I think I'm picking specifically this one here to illustrate. That's showing okay? Yes. The ij lambda vj at evaluated at x sigma equals A plus delta E. And we can just use Taylor theorem to discover that is going to be I J lambda V J at X sigma equals A plus delta A D by D X sigma gamma I j lambda v j at x sigma equals a plus order all I'm doing there is Taylor's theorem to work out what this one is in terms of this. And you can see that when I work out that, so that particular expression evaluated at a plus delta a is going to be that expression plus a bit. So that when I subtract these two things, what I'm left with is this. Okay? I end up with a simpler expression, which is unnumbered in the notes, but between 347 and 348, which I encourage you to set through. But we end up. I'm not going to go through the index manipulations here because they're not terribly edifying. Just you to watch me try to copy indexes from my notes. But you have the notes and you go through them very carefully. But the point is that we end up with more things cancelling and an expression for this, the change in the ith component of this vector. In other words, the ith component of this change vector here in terms of the size of this, the size of this, the vector we started off with, and this rather fiddly expression involving the Christoffel symbols, which, as you recall, tell us information about the way that the coordinates change as we move around. But now we look at this and stare at it a bit, and we realise that this component here is a number. I mean, it's a component of a vector, but it's a number. What number is it? It's the number we get by applying by taking a vector and applying a one form to it. So this one of the basis one forms, which is one of the, if this is the ith component of that vector, we obtained it by applying that vector. So V I is equal to delta V applied to D X I. So this depends on a one form. It also clearly linearly depends on this number DX L. But this how to write that. This displacement here is going to be delta A E sigma. So this displacement vector is something which is a vector which has as its size delta A. So that vector displacement there is also something that's gone in to a thing to get this. So this is also linearly dependent on the size, that size delta A, the size delta B, which we've written a component here, and it's linearly dependent on this, the size of this vector we started off with. In other words, this number, this real number delta VI, is a number which depends on one one-form and three vectors. In other words, this is the, which I've written like this. This number is therefore the what you get when you take a tensor, which we'll call R, named after Riemann, and plug into, it's a 1-3 tensor, we plug in a basis one form, the vector started off with, and there's two sizes of the two vectors which describe the shape and size of this detour. And this vector here is called the Riemann tensor. It has components, this, and it picks up, it encodes information about the way that this vector changes as we move it around the circuit, in a way which picks up from the Christoffel symbols, which picks its value up from the Christoffel symbols. In other words, which we already know contain information, encode information about the way that coordinates change as you move around the space. A question?
Does this assume that there are enough GRDs yet so you can create a full path?
Yes. And there will be, because what we've done is these, we'll set this up, we've constructed this so that these curves here that we're moving along are the curves of constant coordinates. So given a coordinate system, then you will always be able to describe curves of constant, curves of constant x and curves of constant y, or curves of constant r and curves of constant theta, or whatever, or latitude and longitude. So you'll always be able to set up that grid. But of course, what coordinate functions you pick, will affect the number you get here. But that's fair enough. But this is clearly the components of the Riemann tensor in a particular coordinate system. This is the basis one formed in that coordinate system. These are the basis vectors in that coordinate system. So this number is clearly a coordinate-dependent thing. But what we've argued here is that it is nonetheless, we've indicated that nonetheless it's a geometrical object which just has coordinate-dependent components. And I think that's and that's a very important tensor, which is encodes the information about the curvature. Now, there's another way we can define. That microphone is really annoying me. There's another way we can define the Riemann tensor, which I'm going to just which I'm going to mention because we come back to it briefly in a moment. Which is that the Riemann tensor can also be defined in such a way. I'm going to not go through this in detail. It's somewhat peripheral. We'll write this down and then explain what it is. This notation here is a commutator defined so that AB is equal to AB minus B A. And I'm not going to go through and calculate with this, but I mentioned that just in order to show that there is another way of getting to the same point, which in a sense manifestly it doesn't depend on coordinates. I mean, this process here, it uses the Christoffel symbols, it was done in terms of coordinate functions and so on. It feels like it's somehow coordinate dependent, but I will assert that there's another way of getting to the Riemann tensor in that way, more or less parenthetically. Now, if we stick with this version here, then you will recall, I hope, that in a particular coordinate system, you can calculate the values of the Christoffel symbols using the deriving from the components of the metric. So we can. Is this what I have on the next slide? It's not. Annoying. I wish I had a slide saying this, but I don't really want to write this whole thing down. But what I'll do is this is 355. RIJKL is a half GIL, comma J, K minus, and other stuff. I'm not going to write the whole thing down. I should have. I wish I had a slide of it. Now that involves. Is that expression there? I think I'll. Can we turn the autofocus back on to slightly improve that? I'm not sure. So this is the. Quite confused there. If we recall the expression we found for the Christoffel symbol in terms of the metric and its derivatives, and do this fiddly calculation, we end up with an expression like this. And if we do this in a local inertial frame, which makes the whole thing simpler, we end up with an expression for the components of the Riemann tensor in that frame. Now, we can't do very much with that in that frame, and we can't use the Comegos semicolon rule that we found last time, which said that in our local inertial frame, we could turn simple derivatives into covariant derivatives. That works with single derivatives, but not with second derivatives. But what we can do is look at this, stare at it for a while, and discover a number of symmetries of the Riemann tensor. If you swap the first pair of indexes, you change the sign of this component. If you swap the last pair, you change the sign. If you swap two like that, you get an expression which is. That component is the same. So that although there are n by n by n by n components in the Riemann tensor, there are a lot of them are equal. And you can also discover that if you permute the JKL, LJK, KLJ, if you permute the third three components, you can end up with something which is zero. Again, by staring at this. And the point is, although this is we calculate this in the local inertial frame, where that calculation is relatively easy, it's merely tedious and error prone. That's not a tensor equation because of these second derivatives, but we can work out on the basis of that we can work out these symmetries, and because they don't involve any derivatives, particularly they don't involve any second derivatives, these are tensor equations. So these, although we calculate them using this in the local inertial frame, these are not specific to that frame and correspond to tensor identities. Right, we are almost out of time. in order to not run over, because I do really want to finish this chapter. Today, I'll go through the next part fairly quickly. I don't think there are any objectives which depend on the details of this section, but I do want to just talk through them quickly. If you think back to chapter one, I'm going to do this in 1 minute. Actually, I'm not. I will pick this up again at the beginning next time. But I want to try at least got to the end of the chapter. We remember that diagram from chapter one, where things which were in free fall are a significant difference apart from each other. In free fall towards the centre of the Earth, their distance separation between them decreased as time moved on, and the second derivative of that separation was non-zero, even though the things weren't accelerating. These, as we will come to discover, we don't know this yet, because we haven't talked about general relativity yet. These paths are geodesics. The path that something follows as it falls is a geodesic. And so the fact that the separation between the geodesics changes as the objects move through space-time is telling us something about the curvature of the space they're moving through. And so what we discover is through another similar construct, we can talk about pairs of geodesics and talk about the vector joining a family of geodesics. I would talk about the vector joining points on neighbouring geodesics which have the same parameter, and ask how does that vector change. We can say that what we have here is also a circuit in the space. So the Riemann curvature tensor is going to tell us how this connecting vector here changes as we move through that. That's a rather hand-waving remark at this point. But the end point is that jumping to the end is that the second derivative of that connecting vector joining points in two neighbouring geodesics ends up depending on the tangent vector to the geodesic, the x. It depends on how far apart they start off, the size of the connecting vector at the beginning, and on the Riemann curvature tensor. So the Riemann curvature tensor is not just telling you about the shape of the... Well, it is telling you about the curvature, the shape of the space you're moving through. And one of the ways it does so is by saying how quickly these two objects, two things moving along geodesics, how quickly that connecting vector changes. That's a tidal force. That's things like these two things falling toward the centre of the Earth and getting closer together without accelerating. I think that's basically... no objectives depend on the details of that. I encourage you to look through the corresponding part of the notes, but I think that is all I'll say about that. So I think we can therefore declare part three finished. We'll go on to part four next time. I think the overview video is up on the stream site. If it's not, I'll check and I'll make sure that the notes are up promptly. I'll see you in here, I think, next time.